I'm pulling out my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for the drive to work. Okay, so today is the second in my series, Top 20 Most Influential Designs. So this is based on a talk I gave at MagicCon Chicago 2025. And last time I talked about the first seven, or starting at 20. So Mindslaver, Form of the Dragon, Ajani's Pride Mate, Ganti Lord of Luxury, Ball Lightning, Factor Fiction, and Mishra's Factory. Which brings us to number 13, Akroma, Angel of Wrath. Okay, so Akroma, Angel of Wrath is from Legions. So basically in the Onslaught story, there was a character, what was his name? He was a, I'm blanking his name. He had the power to shape worlds, to shape things. He could create things from memory. And one of the things that he made from his memory was Akroma, Angel of Wrath. And in the story, he died by the time of the second part of Legions. And so the big part of Legions was a big fight between Akroma and Phage. Phage was formerly Jessica, who was Kamal's sister, and she got warped. And anyway, she now had a touch where she killed anything she touched. And anyway, in Legions, we really wanted to sort of get the two the two big characters of the story were Akroma and Phage. And they would later merge together with a third person. But anyway, the core part of this story is we needed to make cards for each of them. So I set out to make a card for Phage. And I had a design that I didn't know what to do with, but I liked. I had a design where the card, when it hit another player, it killed the player. Like, it's sort of just one touch and the player was dead. And then I just added on, like, sort of a death-touchy feel. So the idea is, you know, whatever this touches, creature or player, Phage would kill them. That seemed like pretty cool, pretty flavorful, really captured the essence of what Phage was. So Bill Rose, by the way, designed Akroma, Angel of Wrath. So Bill set out to make Akroma. So Bill's idea was that he would, he just wanted to put a lot of abilities on it. So he gave Akroma flying, because Akroma was an angel, that made sense. He gave it vigilance, although vigilance wasn't a keyword yet. He wrote it out, but he essentially gave it vigilance. He gave it protection from red and from black. It's a white character, and black and red are the enemies of white, and protection was a core white ability. He gave it first strike, because that's a core white ability. He gave it trample. Trample was like tertiary in white, but every once in a while, white would get it. And then he gave it haste, which doesn't make much sense. It's really the only mono-white card that doesn't, you know, require red mana or a mountain or something to have haste. But anyway, basically he just made a whole collection of different abilities. And then the funny thing at the time was, I did not like it. Not that I was so much against the design in a vacuum as much as I didn't think it fit a Akroma. So I actually tried, I pitched a whole bunch of other, like, more, this is who Akroma is, and this captures the flavor of Akroma. But none of them were as exciting as what Bill had designed. And Bill was like, look, this is, you know, a main character. We just wanted to be exciting. We want people to be excited by Akroma. And Bill was correct. The card came out, and Akroma was super popular. We even, at one point, we did a 64 head-to-head. This is in the days where legendary creatures weren't all that, you know, we did a lot less legendary creatures. And Akroma won the head-to-head contest. So, and then from that, yeah, it earned the right to get a feature week in her name. She's the only legendary creature to have a feature week on the website. So Akroma definitely was one of those characters that inspired us. She showed up, you know, we've just reprinted the card Akroma a lot. It showed up in a lot of different places. We made a alternate version of Akroma in red. Planar Chaos. We made another version of Akroma, so a normal white version, but like just a different version of the character. We did Akroma's, in fact, in Time Spiral Block, we put her in each set in Time Spiral Block. After she won the contest, we thought it was sort of cool. So her card, her original card was one of the, on the bonus sheet, one of the time-shifted cards. Then She had a time shifter card that was her, but if she was a red character rather than a white character. And then in the third set in Future Sight, we made a Chroma's memorial because she had died, and it shows, you know, sort of reference that she had died. So the idea is she was a character that showed up in all the Time Sprawl sets. Anyway, a lot of things. I mean, one of the real important lessons to me from this was that the most important thing when you're sort of designing key characters is you want the players to really be enamored by them. I know my story background, I really want legendary characters to match who they are and match what they can do. And that is important. I mean, you do want the characters to feel that they match it. But it also is a little bit about, hey, you want them to be exciting and splashy. And so I think it's a good example where we could have been a little more accurate to Akroma as far as what she did in the story. But making her more exciting is something that just sort of stood out. And playing up the awesomeness of her actually ended up making a much more exciting card. The big impact of this is what we call kitchen sink design. And the idea is, it's fun to just make creatures that just have a bunch of keywords. And we do, we've done a bunch that have three, we've done some that have four, we've done a few that have five, we've done, I think, two that had six, and we've done one, we just recently, in Modern Horizons 3, did one that had seven abilities. And so that is just something we continue on. It is, one of the things about design is you just want a lot of sort of tools in your tool belt. And the kitchen sink design is simple in some ways, but very, very potent. And people really like them, so we do that. Okay, that is why number 13 was a Chroma, Angel of Wrath. Okay, number 12 is the Shocklands. So the Shocklands were in original Ravnica. So basically the way they work, for those, some of you don't know it, is they're lands that enter, you can allow them to enter play tapped, they're dual lands. If you enter play tapped, no damage to you. Or you can take two damage, pay two life, and have them enter untapped. So the origin of them is we were making Ravnica. And I knew, obviously, that the Ravnica was centered around enemy color pairs. One of the things we had learned from doing Invasion, which was the first multicolor block, is we really did not support it well enough with mana. So we were trying to be better about supporting it with mana. So I wanted to make dual lands that I thought were cool. So the inspiration for the dual lands was, I just thought back and said, what are cool dual lands we've done? And the two ones I really liked most were the Pain lands from Ice Age. Those were dual lands that you could tap for colorless, or if you tap for one of two colors, did damage to you. Or the other ones I liked were the tap lands from Invasion, which were dual lands that came and played tapped. The problem was that both of those were a little on the weak side. There was room. Like, I remember when we originally made tap lands, we thought we were really, like, pushing the boundaries. And it turns out we weren't at all. We can do, like, obviously nowadays we do tap lands with gain life or do damage to the opponent or scry. I mean, there's other things we do now. Like, that's not enough. So the idea I had at the time was, well, instead of, like, what if we made a land that was both a pain land and a tap land? And so the idea I liked is, okay, it can come and play tapped, or you can pay some life to have it play, come untapped. The reason, by the way, originally the way pain lands worked, they literally damaged you, and paying life seemed a little cleaner. Plus, instead of, like, constantly tracking it, which was a lot to do, especially when your opponent has a whole bunch of lands and their piles, like, it's harder to track when dual lands are being used. So I said, okay, let's just make it simpler. About how much life do you lose using a pain land? The answer I came to was about two. Okay, so what if I just up front made you pay that two up front? So the idea is, hey, using it, you'll lose two life, but instead of, like, tracking it over time, just pay it up front. So that was just to make things cleaner. So anyway... The story is, we make these lands, and then I put them in the file, and I hand them off. And Brian Schneider was the lead developer of Ravnica. And he was like, they felt a little complicated to him. I was trying to explain to him that the reason I don't think they're so complicated is, it's kind of like you have a choice, tapped or untapped. And if it's untapped, you pay life. If not, it's tapped. But it was more cohesive, I felt, than... Anyway, he said he was interested in trying other things. So they tried, like, 20 other dual lands. And then eventually, Brian came back to me and said, you know what? I actually think these are right. We tried a lot of other things. And then we eventually, you know, I decided to give these a try. And you know what? I really liked them. So, can I have them back? Interestingly, a little side note is, not only did Brian take out the dual lands, he also took out hybrid. And in the same case, Brian came back and said, can we put hybrid back in? And this, by the way, no strike against Brian, just a little side note. I think it's okay for people to question things and try things and try other things. And Brian, hey, he realized that, you know what? That was, in fact, the thing that made the most sense. And so he did come back and say, hey, I was wrong, you know, I'd like to put them in. A little funny story, by the way, just to tell, was not, and this wasn't in my talk, so a little bonus story as we listen to my podcast. I did a panel, I think Chicago in 2024, with Aaron, where we were talking about Ravnica. I think Ravnica Remastered was coming out or something. So we were talking about Ravnica. We had a panel all about, like, because Ravnica is a pretty foundational set. A lot of things came from that. So the idea was, we were talking about Ravnica, and before we do the panels, we always do run-throughs. We do a couple run-throughs. So in one of the run-throughs, I'm talking about designing the Shocklands, and Aaron goes, yeah, I don't think that's right. And I go, what do you mean? He goes, you didn't make the Shocklands. Like, we tested like 20 different dual lands. Like, we came to them by just trying lots of different things, and we made them in development. They weren't made in design. And I said, no, that's not the case. So I have all my old files. So I went back and found the handoff file for Ravnica. And in the handoff file are the Shocklands. And then I explained to him that what he didn't know was that Brian had turned them down, and that they had tried other stuff, and that Brian had come back. So Aaron had always thought that the development team had come up with them. He didn't realize when they finally got to Shocklands, it's because Brian just decided to try the ones that I'd handed off. So that was really interesting. Anyway, a little. Aaron goes, okay, I'm sorry, you're right. Which means having your receipts, always good. Okay, so that is why sorry. So the influence of Shocklands, I didn't talk about that. So Shocklands, the one other thing I didn't mention is, one thing I did forget, is Alpha had the dual lands, and Richard had made it such they were both land types. And we really had not gone back to that. Other than the basic lands, we had not put land types on anything. And I was really intrigued, and I said, hey, let's put them on. So I put the land types on the Shocklands. So I forgot that part. Okay, so the Shocklands did a whole bunch of things. One is they've become a pretty staple of, like, what the ideal is of a dual land. I think a lot of things, like, work around them. Like, the Shocklands have really become, like, the perfect example of what dual land should be, and the power level and everything. So we did three things that really have followed suit. One was, dual lands did this first, but I do believe that Shocklands really brought it back to the forefront and said, this is okay to do. And so the idea of dual lands having basic land types, Shocklands really was the one to sort of say, hey, this wasn't a one-of, this wasn't a fluke, this really is something, and it's a knob that we should have. And like I said, up to that point, somehow it was sort of like, oh, like the idea that dual lands were just a little over the curb, people sort of said, well, and part of that is because they're basic land types. I'm like, no, I think we could have the basic land types. And so it definitely allowed us more freedom to do that. Another big thing it did is the idea of, I have an option for how I use it, and it comes and play tapped, or I can pay life and it doesn't come play tapped. Is a tool we've used that a lot, like on the MDFCs. There's a few individual cards. But it's an interesting tool, and it really sort of says, hey, I can have options on, because one of the challenges about making lands in general is that we try to make them so they're not strictly better than a basic land, and so a lot of times that means they need to come and play tapped. And so one of the problems we'd run into is how to get stuff that allows earlier utility, and having the resource of using life to untap them was valuable. The final thing it did is early Magic, I think the way we thought of cycles is we just kind of use them where we needed to use them. We would use them once and then go, okay, we've used them. Okay, toss them aside. Like, we thought them as being very disposable. The idea that we would do things and we'd want to come back and reuse those things. In the early days of Magic, Magic felt like we have infinite things we can do, whatever, you know. And it's only later that we really realized, no, it's a resource, you know. Hey, there's a lot of good designs and good mechanics and good cards, and we need to bring that stuff back, and that's okay. And we really sort of got in the mindset that, you know, we had to think of our resources as something, you know, our things as resources that we want to come back to. As part of that, a lot of the early dual lands just used names that were not reprintable. They would often reference specific worlds, you know, places on specific worlds, or, you know, people, like things that what just made it harder to then put these lands on a different world. So we named the shock lands with names that were generic so that they could go other places. Yeah, they made sense. They fit the guilds they were in, but we wanted the ability to put them other places. And then the irony is the shock lands mostly just showed up on Ravnica, so but it did get us down the path of trying to be more conscious at time of naming things appropriately. Okay, that is why number 12 is the Shocklands. Number 11, Panharmonicon from Kaladesh. So Kaladesh's theme, we wanted to do, we were inspired by like steampunk was the original idea. And we ended up sort of doing our version, we called Etherpunk. But we liked the idea of rather than it being sort of dour and dark, what if it was brighter and optimistic? And then we got the idea of the Inventor's Fair. And I really got enamored of the idea of an artifact set, but where the artifacts were thought of as inventions, of showing off their creativity. One of the things I've always, I've always been a huge fan of artifacts. And one of the things I like about artifacts is they really, more so than almost any other card type, push the boundaries of what was possible. There's just, like, I remember the first time I ever saw Chaos Orb, which you would flip in the air and it would destroy cards it touched. I just like, what? You can do that? You know, and the other one that really stuck to me was Jester's Cap in Ice Age, which allowed you to access the sideboard mid-game. And I was like, what? You know, and it made me realize an idea that I really was a big fan of is the idea, what I called it the marquee card. I said, you know what? Large sets should have an artifact, something that's colorless, that just does things you've never seen before, that people could put in any deck. That, like, I like the idea that every set had one card that just broke your brain a little bit. Like, I didn't know you could do that. And over the time, I would try to do that. And eventually what I realized was it's hard, like, it gets harder and harder to make those. But we were making Kaladesh, and I really wanted to have a little bit of like, ooh, I didn't know you could do that. So one of the cards that I had made when I was trying to make sort of in the marquee days was a card called Mirari in Odyssey, the set I led. And Mirari, the idea of Mirari, originally it was, it just copies all instants and sorceries. Eventually, we had to develop it and ended up, like, you had to pay three to copy it. But the original version of Mirari, by the way, cost more and just copied everything. But anyway, I was really, just a little, my history is, there are certain things that I've always been enamored on. One of them is copying. Fork is a card that showed up in Alpha. It was a red card that let you copy spells. And I put Fork in so many decks. So many. I really like Fork. There's something, I like Clone and Super Doppelganger and Copy Artifact. And I really like the idea of copying things. I thought that was super fun. And I used to do a puzzle column. And in my puzzle column, I would do copy effects all the time. They were super fun in a puzzle column because there were so many options. Like, okay, I can copy something. Ooh, what do I need to copy? And they were great for puzzles. But anyway, I loved copying. So I decided that I wanted to make an artifact that copied things. So I was just trying to find something that was different. And once again, I'm telling a story I did not tell in my talk. In Return to Ravnica, we were trying to find a mechanic for the Azorius. And I came up with a mechanic where this card, all these was on creatures. They were all creatures that had an enter the battlefield effect or now an enter effect. But the idea is that instead of doing their enter effect, they could copy somebody else's enter effect. And originally, at one point, they copied any enter effect. It didn't have to be... Eventually, they ended up being only cards with this mechanic for rules reasons. But anyway, I was playing around with things that could copy other things' enter effects, and it was really fun. Now, that ended up getting killed, and we ended up doing, like, Detain or whatever, but I had played with that and experienced that it was fun. And so I had it in my brain, the idea that copying enter the battlefield effects, once again, enter effects, would be something fun. It was a little bit out there. We didn't have anything like that. And it felt like fun, like, for an enchantment. Like, okay, play, not enchantment, for an artifact. And play this artifact, and then, okay, just play in a deck with lots of, you know, of ETB effects. And anyway, so I made it. So it introduced the idea of an additional time. When you do this thing, do it an additional time. And that became very much a go-to sort of thing. And we've made, in the talk, I just run through all the different effects we've done. You know, whether certain things enter, or certain things die, or they attack, or they're damaged, or you flip them up, or, you know, like, they're just infinite things. There's lots and lots of triggers. And so the idea of copying triggers really became something fun, and we do it all the time now. So anyway, that is why number 11 is Panharmonicon. Okay, number 10, Platinum. Panharmonicon, by the way, I designed. If it wasn't clear as I'm talking about making the card, I designed Panharmonicon. Okay, number 10, Platinum Angel from Mirrodin. Okay, so Mirrodin was during what we call the third age of design. Bill Rose was the head designer. When Bill Rose became the head designer, he had this idea of what if blocks had themes. So Invasion was about multicolor. Odyssey was about the graveyard. Onslaught was about Typal. And Mirrodin was going to be about artifacts. So the idea that I was... And doing an artifact set was something that I had been... Ever since Invasion did multicolor, I really wanted to do artifacts. I've been in Bill's ear and saying, okay, Bill, we got to do artifact block. So finally he said, okay, Mark, time to do your artifact block. And in fact, Mirrodin was one of the first sets where we did sort of what I would call modern world building. The very first set to really do that was back during Tempest. When we were doing the Weatherlight Saga, we brought in a team. So there was some world building done there, but kind of what you think of as modern world building, how we build now, I think Mirrodin was kind of the first set that really did that, where those who don't know, the way we build a world is we bring in a team for like 3 weeks, and they extrapolate things and build things, and we, you know, they build the whole world out of it, we make a style guide that we send the artists. Anyway, Mirrodin was the start of that. And the idea of Mirrodin that we were very enamored was, it was an artificial world, and the world was, like, kind of had mechanics woven into it. That the very nature of the world was mechanical, and that, you know, the seas were made of mercury, and the blades of grass were literally blades. And so the idea was, it was a metal world. And even the creatures had, like, metal woven into their... anatomy, that they, like, the idea was this world was a world of metal because we were doing an artifact set and we just wanted to have a lot of artifact creatures. And so anyway, we spent a lot of time and energy building that. So one of the ideas we had was, what if this world had an angel, an angel made of metal, an artifact creature that was an angel? And we liked the idea so much that we in fact commissioned the art before we even knew what the card was going to do. That is not something we do. We almost never, ever do that. That's very, very, very rare. There are some cases where we have art and we have to kill the card and make a new card. So we do designed art sometimes, but usually it's because we need a design and the art's already done. There have been a few experiments with us designing to art. So we've done it on a few occasions, but it's something we do pretty rarely. But anyway, so not only did we have the art for Platinum Angel, I think we named it. I think we knew it was Platinum Angel. And so the question was, what exactly did Platinum Angel do? So one of the things, just a little about the speech. For each of the cards I talked about, cards or cycles I talked about, I went and figured out who was the designer that made them. Some of which I was there for, so I just remembered. Some of which I had to ask around. You know, I didn't. Like, I knew the East Coast Playtesters made alliances. Not alliances. Made Antiquities, but I didn't realize that, you know, David Petty specifically made Mishra Stafford, stuff like that. Anyway, so I was trying to figure out who made Platinum Angel. So the design team for Mirrodin was myself, Brian Tinsman, Mike Elliott, Bill Rose, and Tyler Bielman. So I didn't remember making it. Now, be aware, I've made a lot of cards. Sometimes I do something and I forgot that I did it, but I just don't remember making Platinum Angel. And I went back and looked at old files, and I looked at... I found some files of me pitch ideas for Platinum Angel, but none of them was the final Platinum Angel. So I called Brian Tinfin. I said, oh, it seems like maybe something Brian did. Brian goes, no, I didn't make Platinum Angel. So I called Mike Eldy. He goes, no, I didn't make Platinum Angel, but I think Bill did. So I talked to Bill. Bill goes, I didn't make Platinum Angel. Tyler didn't make Platinum Angel. So I thought, oh, maybe it was done in development. So I call and talk to Randy Bueller. And Randy was like, I have no idea. He led development. He goes, I have no idea who did this. So I went back and looked at my old articles. I'm like, maybe I talked about it. And, you know, in the past, I knew who did it and I just forgot. And I, in fact, found an article where I referenced Platinum Angel. And I go, I don't know who did this, but I think it's a great design. So this is the only card in all of my 20 things that I don't know the designer. So I just call it the mystery designer. So anyway, we were trying to design Platinum Angel. We were doing a top-down of the art Platinum Angel. So obviously, we knew a few things. It's an artifact creature. It's an angel. We made it a 4/4. It flies. But we wanted something, and like I said, sort of remembering back to the idea of the marquee. So we felt this card really had to go, what? I didn't know you could do that. And somebody, a mystery designer, pitched the idea of you can't lose the game. And your opponent can't win the game. Like, while this is in play, you just can't lose. There's no way to lose while this is in play. And that felt really cool. And, I mean, I think once we had that, we were like, we got it. And it's the kind of effect that we've used a bunch of times. There's something really fun about it. We put it on another angel. We've done cards that sort of do it temporarily. We even did a demon where we did the opposite. We needed a drawback for the demon. And the idea is, oh, you can't win the game while, you can't win while the demon is in play. You have to get rid of him before you can win. So the interesting lesson of this one is this is a card we've printed a lot of times. It was very impactful. And I think it really sort of hammered home the, like, there's an elegance to the card that is very nice. And there is a simplicity. The idea that you can do something that shocks people and really, like, a lot of times I talked with Mindslaver how you can do cool things. But in Mindslaver, it's like, okay, I can write it in a short sentence, but then I have to explain it, and that takes lots and lots of text. It is cool to be able to make designs that are that sort of out of the box and shocking, but simple. And that's something I think Platinum Angel has really become the standard by which we sort of try to hold ourselves to it. From time to time, it's like, not everything that is, eye-bulging, that really makes you go, what, is necessarily complex or necessarily wordy. And it is the perfect example of just a nice, easy, simple, easy-to-understand concept. I can't lose. I got it. That really sort of... Yeah, and you don't need a lot. I mean, that's fine because it's an angel, but like it doesn't need to be busy. It's so elegant. That's the thing I like the most about it, is how exciting it is, how awesome, how flavorful it is, but yet how simple it is. It's not easy to do that. So when we do, it definitely stands as a beacon. Okay, that is number 10, Platinum Angel. Okay, number 9. Number 9 is Misform Ultimus from Legions. Okay, so Legions, for those who don't remember, basically a normal set has some percentage of creatures and some percentage of spells. Normally it's like 55% creatures, 45% spells, normally. But the idea for Legions was, what if it was 100% creatures? So Legions was a set that was all creatures. And it was continuing the story of Onslaught. So this is the same set, by the way, that had a Chrome in it, but a different story now. So Mike Elliott had made a mechanic called Misform in Onslaught. He was the lead designer of Onslaught. The way a Misform creature would work is that you can spend one mana, and then you could, until the end of turn, you could make that creature any creature type you wanted to. It was additive. You could add a creature type to it. And the idea was, Onslaught ended up having a very strong typo theme. And so it's fun that the Misforms could go, oh, you have cards that help your goblins? Well, for this turn, I'm a goblin, and I get aided. And so it played nicely with the typal theme. In fact, by the way, I think Mistform had a lot to do with the typo theme. For those who don't know, I did a whole podcast on Onslaught. Mike had turned in the set. Bill wasn't happy with it because Bill was lead designer. And I did a pass on it. And the thing I really pulled out was, at the time, Mistform was in it, but the typo theme was way, way turned down. And I'm the one that always said, hey, let's turn this theme way up. You know, this should be what our block is about. Like, we should have a typo block. And I got Bill aboard, and anyway, so ended up, the Mistforms really inspired me to turn up the dial of, because at the time, the typo theme was just very low, and I'm like, I thought it was cooler. The idea that I was really enamored by was, I knew that players liked making typo decks, and the typo decks mostly sucked. Like, they weren't particularly good. And one of the things is when players fall over backwards to do something that's not even good, that's a sign there's something really potent that the players like. And anyway, that got me to convince Bill to really make Onslaught a typo block. But anyway, I have a whole podcast on Onslaught if you want to go listen and find out how Onslaught became what it was. Anyway, back to our story. So I was working on Legions, and I decided that I wanted to make a rare legendary creature that was the ultimate Mistform. Mistform Ultimate, right? And so basically, sometimes we do this, is we're making a rare card. Mythic Rare wasn't a thing yet. And I asked myself, okay, I want to make the most splashy, coolest version of this ability. So what is the best form of Mistform? So at first I was like, okay, well, what if you spend one and you can pick more than one creature type? No, we can do better than that. What if you could pick one and be all creature types? No, we can do better than that. Okay, what if you don't even pay one? What if you just are all creature types? And what if you are all creature types, not just in play, but in everywhere? In your hand, in the graveyard, in the library. You know, if I could fetch a goblin, I could fetch Mistform Ultimus. If I could return a goblin from the graveyard, I could return Mistform Ultimus. If I could show you a goblin in my hand, I could show you Mistform Ultimus. So that was the idea. It was just sort of the ultimate version. And the card was super popular when it came out, just because it kind of like played in every typo theme. I mean, you had to be playing blue, but no matter what you were playing, if you had a typo theme and you were playing blue, it fits. You have a Merfolk deck? Oh, you can play Mistform Ultimus. Fine. And even better than that, you could play multiple different typo effects, and he worked with all of them. So basically, Mistform Ultimus did a couple things. One is the idea of being all-inclusive, of like just the power of the word all. Oh, this creature is all colors. Or it has all the names, or it has all the abilities. You know, the idea of the power of all really made me realize that. Also, the idea that things could have qualities in other zones really was exciting. And so that is a well we've gone to a whole bunch of times. But probably the biggest impact is I was working on Lorwyn. Aaron Forsyth led that design. And one of the things we were doing, Lorwyn had a typo theme, and one of the problems we were running into was everything was very siloed, meaning if you cared about goblins, you only cared about goblins, so all you want is goblins. And we wanted some stuff that was more connective tissue. Like, I wanted cards that the goblin player and the elf player might want, for example. And a lot of times when we do that, we think back to the past, and we say, hey, have we done anything like this? And so I thought back to Mistform Ultimus, and I'm like, that is perfect. Why don't we just make Mistform Ultimus into a mechanic? Now, interestingly, there was some resistance at the time, and the resistance was, hey, this is a really cool card. People really like it. If we make a mechanic out of it, we want to make the card less special. And my response to that, and I got some of this from the audience when we made Changeling, and my response to that is, look, we have to make a lot of cards. A lot of cards. I mean, we have 29,000. We have a lot of cards to make, and we keep making them. Match is a hungry monster. We do not have the luxury to go, ooh, here's a really fun thing. Let's just do one card. Like, we don't have that luxury. That if something is fun, we're going to do it again. I mean, kind of the evidence of this entire talk is, we do something, players like it, so we say, hey, let's do more of that. And so the idea that we're just going to not do something to keep the one card special, that's just not the way Magic works. Anyway, so we made Changeling. And Changeling ended up being great. It was really what Lorwyn needed. We brought Changeling back a couple times. It was in Modern Horizons, the first Modern Horizons. It was in Kaldheim. So anyway, it's just become a very useful tool. And so That is why Mistform Ultimus is number 9. So anyway, you might notice that I've hit the past the 30 mark. There's some traffic here. So you get a little bonus content today. So that is why I'm still talking. But anyway, I've not done with the third anyway. So, although I'll give you a trick. When I have traffic sometimes and I realize I have more time, I'll pad my story some so you can hear more stuff. I mean, all good content. Like I said, this is a podcast where traffic means more content for you. Okay, the last one we're going to talk about today, at number 8, is Doran the Siege Tower. So Doran was in, Lorwyn. Like I said, Aaron led it. This was designed by Devin Lowe. Devin led the development for part of the time. I think multiple people led the development. But anyway, so the idea of Dorwyn. So Lorwyn had, we decided we wanted a type set, and we picked 8 creature types. See if I can remember them all. So 6 of them were 2 colors. So that is merfolk, elves, goblins, fairies, Kithkin, and what's the last one? They'll come to me. What was the last one? Anyway, 6 of them had 2 colors. I love when I can't remember something. I always imagine the people at home screaming the thing that I'm forgetting. So what's goblin, elves, merfolk, Kithkin, fairies. Okay, it's going to come to me. We had one, which was elementals, giants was the last of the 6, of the 2-color ones. Then we had one that was 5-color, which was elementals, and we had one that was 3-color, which was tree folk, which were white, black, and green. And tree folk were a little interesting. I think that we had 5 that we sort of did at the base level, and then we had 3 that showed up a little bit less. So one of the questions was what to do with tree folk. So the way it worked was most of tree folk were green. In the talk, there were 16 tree folk cards. I think there were 11 at common, one of which was an aura and one of which was a spell, because tribal, now called kindred, was introduced in Lorwyn. I think there were 5 uncommons and there were 3 rares. Once again, mythic rare wasn't a thing yet. And then there was one for colors. I'm sorry, I was talking about rarities. There were 11 commons, 5 uncommons, 3 rares. And then in colors, most of them were green. There were, I think, 2 mono black and 2 mono white. And then there was 1 black, green, and white, which was the rare card. So we knew we wanted to do a legendary creature for each of the 5 tribes. 8 tribes, of the 8 creature types. We wanted to do a leader of that group. So we wanted a legendary creature that was sort of a leader of the group. So we knew there was a leader of the tree folk. We knew he was black, green, white. But the real question was, what does he do? Like, what exactly does Doran do? That was the challenge. Like, what is king of the tree folk do? So one of the things we had done in the set on all the tree folk was we wanted to give them sort of a mechanical cohesion. So one of the little things we did is we decided that every tree folk in Lorwyn block would have a toughness higher than its power. The very first tree folk, Ironroot tree folk in Alpha, was a 3-5. And it's not, we have made square statted tree folk, and maybe 1 or 2 that have power greater than toughness. But most of the time, it just became a thing we did where tree folk tended to be known for their toughness, right? That one of the things about a tree is it's very tough. It's got bark and its roots, and you know, it's hard to fight a tree. A tree's pretty sturdy. So we liked the idea that it was sort of toughness. They were toughness statted. So one of the questions that Devin had to figure out is, okay, how do I make toughness statted matter, right? How do I make toughness? Because one of the things about game design in general is you need to make the game end. Like you need what we call inertia, meaning I have a podcast called 10 Things Every Game Needs, which you can listen to. It's from many years back. based on an article I did. And one of the 10 things was inertia, meaning your game inherently has to end. You have to build into your game the means by which the players will make the game end, meaning the act of playing the game has to push players toward the end state. Otherwise, the game never ends, and then you sit there, and nothing ever happens. For the little side, when my daughter was little, my kids were little, occasionally we play Chutes and Ladders, and that's an example of a game that doesn't have inertia. The idea for those who never play Chutes and Ladders is you're rolling dice on a board, you're trying to get to the end, and sometimes you land on ladders that you climb up, so you skip spaces, but sometimes you land on chutes, and chutes send you back. And my pet peeve whenever we play Chutes and Ladders is they always put the same amount of chutes and ladders. Chutes are like slides. And then the idea is, like, just put more ladders than chutes. Like, make the game end. Because I used to, the number of games I had to cheat to let my daughter win just so the game would end. I would roll and count it wrong just so I wouldn't hit the chute and the game would end. Anyway, that's the importance of inertia. So Devin is trying to figure out, how do I make toughness make the game end? And then he came up with a pretty clever idea. He goes, what if this creature said, instead of using your power, you use your toughness? That creature's damaged with toughness. And so what it said is, hey, I want you to build a deck of creatures with higher toughness than power. That you want toughness status creatures. And it's it makes the game end. It just makes them more powerful. It turns toughness status creatures into more powerful creatures for purposes of doing damage. And that was great for tree folks because all the tree folks had higher toughness. So essentially the idea is if you play Doran in a tree folk deck, especially in a Lorwyn tree folk deck, he just makes all your tree folk more powerful. Then to be clever, we gave him his power toughness is 0-5, which is very clever because obviously he does damage with his toughness, not his power. But anyway, we made that card. It was it was instantaneously loved. That ability, the idea of toughness, turning toughness into power, is something that we R&D refers to it as the Doran ability. It's just something we go to again and again. And it was a really clever solve for something that's really nice, which is making toughness aggressive. And so it's an ability we go to again and again. And so, anyway, that is why Doran the Siege Tower is 8. So anyway, guys, I can see the building from here. I have one more podcast. I will do the final 7 in the last podcast. Anyway, I hope you're enjoying this. Like I said, by the way, if I hadn't reminded you, I did a talk in Chicago. The talk I did is online. You can go if you like Google for Mark Rosewater and top 20 most influential card designs. Hopefully you will find this talk. And so the talk live, I have a lot of slides, a lot of images, and I'm trying to make it so that I'm covering a lot of the same material in my podcast, but I'm telling some stories I didn't, and there's some stuff I did in the talk that I don't do here. So the talk and the podcast, while they cover a lot of same ground, there is a lot of differences. So if you enjoy this, and you want to see the talk is up so you can see it. Anyway, guys, I'm just about to get to Wizards, and I'm way over time. So we all know what that means. It means it's the end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. I'll see you all next time. Bye-bye.